happenings, the social events, and so on.
Yeah,
and
we've
done quite a bit. We had a good story on the school. Where were you the night of Hurricane Hazel?
The night of Hurricane Hazel, we were in our house. We stayed in there all night. One thing, remember, nobody expected the water level to come up quite that high. Everybody thought a foot or two. This is a general talk in the community. They thought it would come up a foot or two, maybe 3 feet, but that's about it. Nobody expected it to come up as high as it did.
How much did it rise? It rose, like, how much did it have to rise before it would go over the dike?
Over the dikes? Well, the dikes weren't that high then. Okay, the dikes were raised after that. It'd be around 723, 723 and a half. They weren't that high as they are today.
723 is the number of feet above elevation above sea level.
Yeah.
And the marsh is considered to be 715,
716, depends. If you're along the dike in the marsh, you are 4 feet higher on average than if you're right by the river. There's approximately a 2% slope. Approximately. Doesn't always, sometimes it's less. But in general trends, it's like it's awesome. Okay. So anything in the middle got substantially more water than anything along the dike. Now, our basement would be about 6.5 feet high, and it got about 4.5 feet of water, 5 at the most. So if you're along the dike, you had substantially less than if you were in the middle. In the middle, you had it.
Now, but how much did the North Canal, the North Branch, how much did it come up before it started to go over the dike?
Okay, well, that day, the day of Hurricane Hazel, I went to Bradford with my dad, and the comment was, if we don't get a flood, I don't know. Because if you went up 400 Highway and you look to the east, that whole area was one big lake. Okay. So everything was sort of backed up. There's a lot of water standing all over. And the canal itself run in reverse for 3 days prior to Hurricane Hazel. Very gentle slope upwards. So it filled all of the floodplain.
What you're saying is that the water from Lake Simcoe was running back down in towards Bradford.
That's right.
Is that because of the prevailing wind?
Prevailing winds and because of the water level of in flux. But the lake only raised a foot, okay? That Hurricane Hazel. But you gotta remember, the marsh is flat, the Holland River is flat. So there is no fall between the marsh and Cook's Bay, Lake Simcoe. So you have to build the head to force it that way. But it had a very slow trend running in reverse.
So was there a general, like you say, you stayed in your house.
Yeah.
But you were aware there was a real problem.
Oh, everybody was aware at 7 o'clock at night there was a real problem.
And it happened very suddenly.
At the North Branch it did. More so than any place else. At the North Branch, things were going in reverse. They had to come forward sooner or later. And once they came forward, it just took the dike right out. As Elephant Dike that was there, that lived right there, said it come in about a 3 or 4 foot wall. It hit the dike and just put the 3 or 4 foot wall on the top and then it washed it out. Yeah.
Is there something...
So whether there was something upstream holding it back that broke loose, about the only thing I think. You've got to remember, at the time of Hurricane Hazel, the canal was also in very poor condition. There was a lot of trees in it. There was places where it was pretty well full. We could walk across, because I can remember doing that. So everything had deteriorated from the initial outset. And it wasn't maintained the way it should have been maintained. And that's another story. So it broke at the North Branch. Washed out there. Then it broke just at Haydus. Okay. That was the other place where it broke through the dike.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it broke through about here. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's where it broke through. And it also broke through at the corner here.
Yeah. which is down by Highway Number 9. We won't get into this is a Hurricane Hazel story is one that we're is a story in itself, like, you know, but I mean it's
I gotta tell you one little Hurricane Hazel story. A fellow by the name of Padgett with the Department of Public Works. Okay. He was put in this area to look after things for the province and look after the province's money. Okay. And I can't think of the name of the other fellow that fell under him that was his right hand man. Anyways, Padgett was a great guy. He was up north a lot. He was a great guy for dynamite. And the river had to be cleaned out. The ditches had to be cleaned out. And Padgett said, we could do it by dynamite. So I went along with the right-hand man in one of those panel trucks, and we went up to the CIL factory there up north.
Nobel.
We picked up the dynamite. We had the battery, the caps, and the dynamite all in the panel. And we headed back. Then when we got back, what did we do with this dynamite? There was a little shed between the north and southbound lane on the south end. And that was the office where they had to collect the time. It was John DeWinter and myself hired to collect the time from the people that were working and pay them once a week for Department of Public Works under the direction of this pageant. So we piled all the dynamite around the shed. Little office, 10 by 10 office in there. And that's where the dynamite stayed for 2 or 3 days till we used it. Put it, five or six sticks together, foot apart in the river, set the charge off, which was straight up, the river bank went like this, come back down, everything came back down, nothing changed. It was exactly the same. It's like sticking your hand in a bowl of jelly, take it out, everything's back to normal. Then we cut them in half, put them in the ditch. By Charlie Davis there. And it sort of made a ditch that went in and out. It wasn't consistent. So that was a little bit too much of a charge. And we cut them in quarters and put them a foot apart in the ditch. Well, there wasn't enough concussion to set the charge off all the way, just the first one went off. So we dug them all up by hand, put them on a bushel in the middle of the road, blew them up, and that was the end of the dynamite. I can remember that just like yesterday, doing that. Ever got hit, we wouldn't have been here.
Oh, dear. Well, especially that thing of bringing everything down together in the same vehicle, you know, all the caps and everything.
I know. That's
people forget that the dangerous part of dynamite is dynamiting is the caps.
Yeah.
The dynamite doesn't do very much by itself. But anyway. Okay.
I had to tell you that one on the side there. That's.
Well, I think the thing with Hurricane Hazel, too, is the fact of of it being every 50-year storm or 100-year storm.
No, 100-year storm.
But by the same token, I don't know if you ever, there was one in 1921, which was quite similar, the only thing was that the marsh was not, it was just a wetland at that time. But it came down, started up at the 10th line, and came right down and took out the
Five Sides?
Well, took out the Five Sides, and also Scanlon Creek took out the railway bridge and stuff like that. But it was basically just a cloudburst.
Yeah, over an isolated area.
Over an isolated area. But I mean, it was those things happened.
Well, that's just like when the golf course was built here in Bradford, okay? Yeah. Roads are designed for 1 to 10 year storm. Very rare one, 25-year storm. Took all the culverts of the road out at the golf course twice in the same year. Had 2 inches of rain and one cloudburst. Okay. Took all the pipes out. That whole bottom area was flooded. And if that same thing happens today where the nursing home is, in the nursing home, that pond is not near big enough to handle. Because it was 3 times as big and it was full at that time. I expect someday to see that will go over.
Well, it's the same thing. Well, we won't get into that.
No, I don't. We get into a lot of things different.
I'm still waiting. I'm still waiting today to see the no-frills underwater.
That's another one. You're right.
That's another one. Anyway, we'll wait and see. What's the main change in Springdale when you were a young lad as to Springdale today? Has it changed that much?
Oh, it's changed a lot, really. Number one, you don't have the workforce. You don't have the people like you used to. everybody was close together, was a community. They would get together, they would, if somebody got married, everybody in the community was invited. And they'd clean out a barn, sweep the floor, and that's where they would have the reception. Mm-hmm. Okay? And I've been to many a wedding in the barn. There was lots of that. Today they won't allow you to do it. Laws won't permit you to do that. It's not safe. You know, that's the sad part. That's the sad part of today's society.
Who makes that decree?
Well, the building code says you can, if you have an assembly, you have to have so many exits, this, that, and it. So the moment you do something in a barn, you're taking the risk of not complying with anything. That's your problem today. And that's the sad part about society. There was many good community events that way. And the wedding, everybody came. You don't have that today at all. Today they're gone off to some restaurant or something else. And there was a little bit of drinking. There wasn't that much drinking.
No, well, I mean, I think that was there was like every other rural community.
Yeah.
Up before shall we say 1950, 1960, there basically the rural communities were dry.
Yeah.
But that changed.
So there was many a great thing like that. You don't have that today at all. The automobile and money between those two has basically put a wedge between communities, mm-hmm. because people travel now. They don't get together. Before they had no money, they had to walk. So they visit their neighbors, they talk to their neighbors. Now you get in a car, you wave as you go by.
What was the big change that we were talking with Jim Brickhike and that was what he was saying, that in 1958 it was the big change on the marsh with the introduction of the pallet box and the harvesters.
Okay.
Was that just a change that happened like overnight, or did it gradually?
No, that was a change. I would say before all the weeding, there was no chemicals to kill the weeds. So you had to have armies of people crawling up and down these fields to remove weeds between the lettuce, carrots, onions, celery, whatever else it may be. And if you didn't, you got overrun with weeds, and then you were in real troubles. Okay. So there was armies of people for that. You had to have people, onions were pulled by hand, put in a bushel, piled on a wagon, taken to a one-row topper, and they were topped and bagged, and the bags were sewn and piled up. That's the way it was done. The carrots were all pulled by hand, and a lot of it was piecework. You've got 10 cents a bushel or something like that. I think the last time I did it, we got up to 12 cents a bushel. I think it started out at 8 cents, got to 10, then it got to 12. You pulled them by hand, broke the tops off, and you could do, a good person could do 110 bushels in a day. A kid could do 40 bushels in a day. And they had to be loaded on the wagon and hauled in the barn and packed in the barn. So there was a lot of manual handling, more than once, two or three, four times, whatever the case may be. Then, so everything was done that way. Then they started to get chemicals for weeds. That started to come. And that sort of changed the weeding to a point. It reduced a lot of labor in that regards. Then Louisville Falls was bedridden for a year. And Louis done a lot of weeding. And I think Louis was about one of the first guys to get a combine. Okay. Combine onions. And everybody said it's going to bruise the onions. They won't peel. They'll rot. They'll this. They'll that. But it proved out that that didn't happen. And the varieties got better. The old yellow globes used to be very soft onions. And that got better. And then the care combine came. And that drastically changed the situation. But there was still, when we had onions, and when the onion combine was there, well, I should go back for a minute. Sorry, getting ahead of myself. There was the one roll topper made by Charlie Fallon Schomburg. He made those. and there everything was brought to that one, and they were topped. Then they come out with a 5 or 6 bed topper on a little trailer. So you had, you pulled that ahead, you gathered the bushels within a certain area, you topped them, and you bagged them. They just topped it into a bag, or you put in crates. Then there was the combine. And a lot of the combines took bags at first, and they were bagged, and the bags were sewn and stacked. Okay. Then the pallet boxes have come in, and at first it was, well, you're not going to get them dry. You're going to put them in the storage. They're going to rot because they won't dry out. 25 in a box, that isn't going to work. And you had that, so it was, everybody was very skeptical about that, so it took a few years to get that in. And then when the care combine came out, then it really, by that time the pallet boxes were starting to prove themselves, and carrots had to be moist, and that's when the real drastic change came. So by that time they had the chemicals for the weeds, they had the combines for the onions with the pallet box, and then they got the care combine. And that just dropped labor. Completely different. It changed the whole picture.
What did the change did it make then to the marketing of your crop?
Not that much. Other than you didn't have to manhandle it.
So everything went, instead of loading bags of onions or bags of carrots or bushels of carrots onto trucks to take to the packing house.
Right.
You just loaded pallet boxes.
Yeah, you just loaded pallet boxes. Because before, like, we rented our barn out to United Farms on several occasions, extra space, and we would get 15 cents a bushel. We would unload, they would bring the truck, we'd unload the truck, pile them in the barn, stack them up, I don't know, 10, 15 miles. And then we'd load that truck again, all for 15 cents, and plus they stored it for that length of time.
These were bushels you're talking about?
Yeah, these were bushels. And there was a lot of that in the co-op, too. It was a lot of labor, man labor. So when that came in, that changed the whole picture of the marsh. Plus, once you didn't have the labor force, the production, you can produce it cheaper, and the prices remain fairly constant. So it changed the whole set of everything.
I can remember when we first came up, we came up in 1954, 1955, and seeing busloads of people.
Yeah,
on the marsh. Yep. There were whole busloads of people came up, worked on the marsh.
Yep.
They went, picked them up down and done that
down the junction.
Down the junction. Yep. They'd get on the bus every morning and come up to work on the marsh. They'd get paid when they got off the bus on the way home.
Yep.
And
today
they were Mrs. Smith, and tomorrow they were Mrs. Jones. And
if you had a bad one, you didn't have them back.
You know, and so that was it.
They basically went down there, and anybody that wanted to get on the bus and work, got on the bus and worked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it changed the whole picture, but you also got to remember, from when I was a kid, if you got 500 bags of onions off an acre, you had a booming crop. Today, if you got 500 bags off an acre, you lose your shirt. That's a terrible crop. I mean, we're looking at more like 1,100 bushels off, or bags off an acre. And the same thing with carrots. The production has doubled.
Well, same thing in the highland.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
So, we nobody talks about it much, but it's the reality. People get worried about with the loss of farmland and the loss of this. And
oh, yeah.
But by the same token, while it is an issue, it isn't as... The management and the fertility and everything else associated with this.
So what happened? Once you got the combines and you got that, you didn't need the labor force. This combine could take care of 10 acres just as easy as it could take care of 20. Okay? So what happened is you start getting bigger farms. Because I got this combine sitting there that I'm only using in the fall. And then in that time period for the production I can put across that, I could run 30 acres through there or 50 acres through that machine as opposed to 5 or 10.
But the point is, it's like having equipment on the farm. It used to be like not so much
right.
Now because we've got to let these great big units, a lot of these farms, we only have about 5 or 6 farmers in West Gulf.
Right? That's right. Yeah.
But we won't get into all that.
But that was a big change. that really became changed the whole picture.
Okay, we're not going to, I don't think in our book we're going to get into the problems of marketing, the evolution of marketing, because people, that's a whole story in itself. And I'll leave that for somebody like you to write the book about
that. Yeah, that is
a grant. We're going to spend a few minutes and talk about the Holland and Marsh Drainage Commission. The Drainage Commission basically was started about, what, 1930?
The Drainage Commission, yeah, about 1928 they started pumping.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would say 28 sort of started. I'd have to look it up exactly here.
In the records I found in doing that with my research, they had an arrangement where it initially started out, it was more or less the responsibility of the township of West Gwillimbury to do the job, and Professor Day wasn't very happy with the way that the township of West Gwillimbury was doing the job. So then he got it organized so that they formed a committee of the growers on the marsh and the municipalities. And then that became the Holland Marsh Drainage Commission. I think that was likely somewhere around 1933, 35, something like that.
Originally, the Holland Marsh Drainage Commission was the three Rees, West Gwillimbury, King, Bradford.
I see.
They were doing it. They were squawking, and West Gwillimbury was in a shady municipality, yes. They squawked about it. So then they had the three Rees became the commission. And they were looking after the operation of this marsh, the scheme. Mm-hmm. Okay, the maintenance or the repairs, whatever it may be. Then the farmers were saying, we get saddled with all this cost, but we have no say. And there's some guy from the Highland that's sitting on council telling us what they're going to do with our marshland. And that did not necessarily go that well. So then they asked if some of the farmers could be on this commission. And they originally said no, but then they come back and agreed to allow. I think they started out with two farmers on it, and then it worked up to three. And as usual, things go down the road, and then there was another big fight or explosion, as I would call it. And they added more. And in 1970, there was, and they relied a lot on the engineer. They relied a lot on the engineer to advise them what to do, and they basically accepted the engineer's recommendation. They relied on the engineer too much. The engineer was in Chatham. Okay. He would not know what the weather's doing and stuff up here. And Vic Bardwell, who I worked with for quite a while, a very nice man, He gave me the history of the marsh and taught me a lot of things. He's the guy I learned most of my stuff from. He says, I'm in Toronto. They expect me to phone down to the marsh and tell them when to pump. Well, he says, it may have rained in the marsh, but it didn't rain in Toronto. I had no way of really, truly looking after the system. And in 1970, there was another big uproar. And we changed the commission from three farmers to a total of nine, three councils, so seven. We added seven farmers. And we tried to get a mix, half from King Township, half from Bradford, West Gwillimbury, or West Gwillimbury at the time, and one in the marsh and the other in the marsh, get a cross-section across the marsh. And we advertised that, and we got a cross-section. And that was a nucleus after 1970 of the marsh. Commission as it stands today until 1982, when they changed the Drainage Act and appointed drainage superintendents. But if you go back through the history, they had this commission that was looking after it. They have always recommended that they hire somebody to look after the operations of this market, whether it was a superintendent, but somebody to look after the things, to make sure the pump's running and everything else. A superintendent, as they call it. Mm-hmm. They never wanted to spend the money. It got changed from year to year, but you can find that recommendation, that recommendation, that recommendation, that recommendation. Carried right through from the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, not till the 80s did that happen.
So basically what you're saying is the three Reeves, who basically were the Hall and Marsh Drainage Commission, they managed the marsh themselves.
Yep. They kept their separate minutes, okay, and they managed the marsh themselves.
But there was somebody who was a secretary of that. But would there be somebody like yourself? Were you a secretary for them for that group?
No, there was they done that.
Or was that a township? One of the townships.
That's one of the township. Clerks done that. Okay, that done the secretarial work. That was constant township clerk that done that right up to the 80s.
But they always had somebody, like I can remember, Hult Stoddart was, Harry Barron was in charge of the pumps for a while. Stoddart was in charge of the pumps for a period of time.
Well, what the Reeves did, because they would always get into a flack, because there was nobody there to really look after the operation of the system. And that's why they recommended a superintendent. So they hired, and one of the first ones you can find is Charlie Davis, because when they originally done the marsh, they needed irrigation at dry season. So they just cut a hole through the dike, and that's how they let the water in, for irrigation purpose. Well, nobody worried about that hole in the dike. And one spring, it became a real problem, that hole in the dike. Okay? So they hired Charlie Davis to be a dike walker, as they called him. And he had to walk the dike to make sure that the dike was all right. And Charlie done that for quite a while. And there was, and I can't think of the names, and there was a couple more that done it as well. They were the dike walkers. The pumps themselves, they had somebody run them, but they had mostly the person that lived right beside the pumps kind of looked after that. So in this end of Bradford, can't think of the gentleman's name anymore that lived right beside the pumps. Was it Duga? Duga, I think. He looked after them for a while. And on Springdale side, those pumps weren't installed until they put Highway 400 through. When they put Highway 400 through, Department of Highways paid for the two pumps, the two electric pumps. They were installed, that was done by Highway. And Albert Van Dyke, who lived right there, looked after that. But there was always a fight. The farmer close to the river wanted the water low. The farmer close to the dike wanted the water higher. There was always this constant battle, the level of the river should be.
I know our Bill, I know, you remember our son worked on worked the pumps that one summer.
Yep. It was a battle all the time.
And, you know, it would rain. And so it would take about 3 to 4 days for the water from up the river to come back down to the pumps. But the fellows up there lived, come on, get the pumps going. I got to get the water off my farm, you know. And here the water was going to be 3 or 4 days before it got there. And so you turn the pump on, and Bill would say, well, you go and turn the pump on. The pump would go whoosh, 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 whoosh.
Vortex.
It was no water there to pump.
Well, I can remember as a kid already, where there was big controversy, okay, about the marsh drainage. Because the river itself, which is the main drain, the old Shawmut Riverbed through the Northern Marsh, became the main drain. And it was stagnated with weeds. So you couldn't get the flow through the river because of the weeds. And that was the biggest problem.
You mentioned something rather interesting there. You referred to it as the Schomburg River. Yeah. Is it the Holland River, or is it the Schomburg River? Or is the Holland River and the Schomburg River at least synonymous only?
You will find in some places you'll find the Schomburg-Holland River, and other places it'll be Holland River, and other places it'll be Schomburg River.
So take your choice.
Take your choice. It's been one that you could argue, and has been argued for years, and nobody knows exactly where the Schomburg River stopped and where the Holland River began.
Well, the Schomburg are the headwaters of the Holland.
Right, they are. They're all part. But
going back to the commission, who looked after what is known as the Bradford Marsh?
Looked after the Bradford Marsh. That was completely separate. That had nothing to do.
Is it still separate?
It's still separate. That had nothing to do with the commission, the Holland Marsh Drainage Scheme. That was completely separate. Bradford, the town of Bradford proper looked after that one.
That's why I understood that. But I've heard for people who know everything about it, they tell me, oh no no, it's all run in one unit.
Nope.
I just clam up because I know from what I
today it is, not that it's not run as one unit. It's run as a separate unit, but it's looked after by the same person.
I see. Okay. All right. So that comes back to the same kind of thing we're talking about, Holland and Schaumburg. It's a better semantics.
But up till a few years ago, it run by the town of Bradford.
So who's looking after the marsh now? Do you do that?
Yeah.
You're the superintendent of the.
Yeah, just put a headache to it. I can tell you a story about that one.
in which context? Like is the responsibility? Like,
no, we have.
Do you report to? Or like,
No, that's no problem. That hasn't been a problem. It's not that way. We've got a pump. Well, pump broke, burned out twice. PUC used to lift the pump. Since Barry Hydro took over, they said, hydro wires are there, you got to stay so many feet away. You can't lift the pump through the roof. Well, the pump's all one unit. The only way it can come out is through the roof.
Is this one of your new ones down here?
No, this is a little Professor Hayward.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so they said, what do you want to shut the power off with it? $4,000, isolate the line, pull the pump. $4,000 to isolate, put it back in. I said to John Ballard, who I mostly deal with, because he runs most of the marsh, I says to him, my advice is we get one of these little pumps like we have the new pumping station, put that in there, we can lift it, we don't have to worry about the hydro lines. We can manhandle it, we don't need a crane or anything like that. So removing the pump, repair of the pump, the cost is substantial to us. So I went to council, made this recommendation, we bought the pump. Pump comes from Germany. Okay, that's where we bought this one from. We bought it off of ABS as a burst of flight because they could give us a lower RPM and the cost was cheaper. Okay. So it has to fit in the can. But John Bell, this is sort of off the record type of thing.
Whereas this gives us a bit of an idea on the whole Marsh Drainage Commission part, and we'll it's part of our story.
Yeah.
We want to mention about the Holland Marsh, how the Holland Marsh Drainage Commission works, and so on. And if you have, you've given me some. I have some files at home, some information that you gave me when I was doing the book.
Well, I'll carry it just a little farther. That's Reese were the first one. Then they got the farmers on it. 1970, we expanded it to and tried to get it.
Okay, we're just going to 1960. We're just going to 1960.
Oh, you're just going to 1960.
So that looks out. We can run.
Yeah.
We can overrun. We're going to overrun on times, but we can say that this followed through till 1970 when a major change was made.
Yeah.
But really,
and then another major change was made in the 80s when they proclaimed the Act of Drainage Superintendent.
Oh, we're not going to get into that because with what we want to do.
But
how? In other words, the thing is that the the marsh is managed as an entity in itself.
The marsh is managed as an entity in itself. It was constructed under the Drainage Act, but did not always follow the terms of the Drainage Act because the Drainage Act, and they figured the cost of circulating and all this stuff. There was more important things that had to be done on the spur of the moment as opposed to by the time they circulated it was too late, the flooding would have occurred and the damage would have happened and so on. So it was run as a on its own, but not always 100% in conformity with the Drainage Act.
Okay, and so if you are a landowner on the marsh, pay municipal taxes on your property the same as everybody else does.
Yeah.
But you also pay a drainage charge.
You always pay a drainage levy. Yeah.
A drainage levy.
Yeah.
Who determines the drainage levy?
That was determined by the commission and the engineer. The engineer would recommend to the drainage commission, I think we should charge so much an acre. And I think this is the work that we are going to do. They always pass bylaws up our race. They were supposed to circulate that bylaw to everybody within the area that was charged drainage, and that didn't always happen. They always pass bylaws and stuff. Okay. And West Granbury, via the initiating municipality, had to notify King Township when they were doing this work or passing a by on them and give them the right to appeal if they're not.
Okay. One of the, you mentioned there back a little while ago, mentioned the major problems was the fact that the old river bed, the old river,
yep.
is the drain, the main drain.
Main drain.
And that it gets, in order to have a main drain that works, it has to be clean and tidy and unobstructed. Now, you've gone through a whole series of things starting. How did they, what were some of the first steps that were taken to clean it out?
It was a problem.
You went from barges with drag lines, and then you went to Louis DeVos.
Okay. It started out basically with a drag line cleaning it out. And the unfortunate part, if anybody was operating a machine and didn't know peat soils, you would drop the bucket in, pull it. And that's normally the way you do a drag line, lift it out, dump it. But there's holes in the bucket. And by stirring this peat material up in the water, most of it would run out before you got it to the shore. So you would get very little peat. But he could drop to the bottom and hit the hard pan or the clay material, and he'd take a lot of that out of time, and then that way he lowered the drain. And that was always a big controversy. You're taking clay out, you're leaving the muck, and you're not doing it. And yes, that was a real problem, and they couldn't do it. And there was places where they couldn't get at it. So there was bulrushes for a big area, so they would have to get at it from the other side. So the course of the river bed did change to a point over the years because of the simple fact they couldn't get at it to do it. They also tried a clam and used that on a barge, a floating barge, to clean up the river. That was also done. But you could clean out today, and if you had a wet spring, the peat soil moved so fast, and there was, I would estimate, over 600 ditches in that marsh, man-made, hand-dug ditches. And a lot of sediment would flow into the river wherever these ditches went in, and it could be plugged within 2 years from when you cleaned it. So there was no easy method. And there was always a lot of controversy, a lot of harsh words spoken about it. You know, I got my ditch, the water can't run in there. You know, you're not looking after this river. And I know they have gone in with a motorboat on when they had a real bad season just to try and get a path through the middle for the weeds. And this thing has been debated and struggled with over the years. In the 60s, the provincial government said they would pay the cost of a study and get the most learned people they could to look at this situation and solve the problems once and for all. Nothing wrong with those people, and they've done an admirable job, but it didn't solve the problem because they didn't have a machine to clean it out. That was the biggest problem. Went over to England, and they had exactly the same problem as we did, exactly the same over the years. So this drag line would clean up the weeds, but it would be a continuous thing. And you couldn't do it during crop season, so it had to be done in the wintertime. And the farmers would chew because they're taking more ice out than they're taking material out. And we're just paying for them taking ice out of the river. And then the ice, and then a bit of dirt would go over top of the ice. Then the ice wouldn't thaw out until June. They couldn't work the land. It was just an ongoing struggle. The recommendation in the 60s from this committee was to buy 100 feet all the way along the river for drainage purpose. That was the biggest problem. The other interesting thing in the marsh, going to drainage, and they had municipal drains where they could tie in. Who gets the dirt? Because they used to have to weed all of the fields by hand. In these ditches, you would get a lot of weeds from these ditches. So if you put the dirt on my side, I've got all these weeds that I can't control, and I got to pay all this labor to have this looked after. And the other guy didn't get the dirt, and he can weed it twice as fast. That was a real problem too. Who got the material? Because they got all these weeds. And one person would spray their ditch bank, the other person wouldn't spray their ditch bank. and that became a real problem. There has been a couple of occasions where the person was faced looking down the barrel of a gun. That has happened. Yeah, on a couple of occasions. Fights over these drains. I personally had experience where the guy parked his truck in front of the machine and I had to go down there. And it was all where the dirt was placed. That was the whole dispute. Mm-hmm. After you got everything sorted out, it took a half a day to get that, to figure out the farmer why he was upset. Mm-hmm. It was just where the dirt was going. Mm-hmm. And he'd move his truck an inch, and the machine go up to his truck, and then he'd move another inch. And this is the way the battle went for a whole morning. Until we got sorted out where the dirt was going to go, to his satisfaction, and it was fine.
When did Louis start with his snowblower?
1977. Yeah. 1977. But prior to that, we had these drag lines. Then in the 70s, early 70s, we tried to find somebody that would have a machine or could make a machine or whatever. Jack Fulop in the 60s went with Vic Bardwell to Europe to look at machines. And they found nothing that was realistic that would work. And so Louis DeVals and Vic Bardwell traveled Ontario to try and see about the machine, because Louis was the most mechanical inclined person in the marsh. Okay. And they did come up, they weren't even what you call them, a ship gun, but they did come up with a company in Belleville that did give them a price to make a machine. And I have a copy of that, there's a copy of the records of that. It was $350,000. But you supply the engineer drawings and everything else. That's just the builder. You supply everything else. We'll build what you want. We won't guarantee it works. We'll do exactly what you want. $350,000. That wasn't satisfactory. Louis, so then, I'm ahead of myself, pardon me. Vic Bardwell knew of a fellow by the name of Cummings in Toronto that done work on the docks, around the dock area. He said he could make a machine and do it. He made a machine, and we gave him a contract of $50,000 a year to maintain the river for 5 years. They wouldn't build it unless we gave him a contract. The only problem was Cummings did not have the financial resources. He had a good idea, but he didn't have the financial resources. And we wound up supporting some of that money to come back later on. And he made the machine, put it in the river, and that was before 77. That would be about 5 years before that, more or less. I can get the exact date. And this machine went through the river, and it was a bucket on a chain, and it dropped in a hopper and it blew out. Well, you know Joe Mooney's son that passed away since. Remember Joe Mooney?
I don't remember Joe.
Yeah, but his son was helping Cummings operate. The only problem was he was a drinker, and the farmer started to complain because he dropped the beer bottle in the and they shoot out pieces on the field. That was a problem.
Well, you everything with the best of intentions, but you never anticipate all the problems.
No, it was the best of intentions, but unfortunately he didn't have the money to really do it right. And Rex Rand or something like that, I have to look it up, in Aurora, built the hull for this thing. But he tried it with a boat impeller first, and the asset would keep moving. So he put spuds along the side. And that worked well. The spuds weren't good. They kept it solid. He dropped the spuds and do that piece and then drop the spuds. So he never fulfilled his contract. He never got the hours in. It would either break down because it didn't have equipment. Okay. And it broke down. And eventually we said, that's it, we cannot have this any longer. We're not getting anything done. And in the spring we'd have to support it with some money for the fuel to get going. So that's when Louis went with Vic Bardwell to look and see if we could get some. And that's when we got this other price. There was never really much said about that other price. They said, well, there's nothing really to do. It was mentioned, but very casually, everybody dropped it. We convinced Louis to build it. asked him to do it. He refused to do it on several occasions, but eventually he did. And he would guarantee it through work, and it was $125,000.
And basically what this was a muck blower. Same as you have a snow blower, mm-hmm. only this one just had a snout on it and just went down the river and just gathered up all the muck, you see, like this.
Well, there was originally that machine was to be built by buckets, same as Cummings, maybe it was, okay. And I found an article about augers, okay, about a thing with augers, and gave that to Louis. And Louis, in turn, checked it out and said, yes, that's a good idea, and then it got changed to auger system. Okay. And the lady that was working for us in the office, Carol Hacking, her husband made the augers, her company that he worked for. And we didn't know that, we didn't know that until later on, that Louis bought the augers from her that company.
But one of the biggest problems they had in doing this was the black plastic that kept coming, into the growing and going in there. And so it would get this black plastic, you get all wrapped up in these augers and stuff.
There was plastic. Other thing was, from the drag lines, when they had to put a new cable on, they seemed to throw the old one in the river for some reason or that. We have picked those up on numerous occasions.
The other change that happened on the marsh too was the fact that, as Art mentioned, originally everybody had an open ditch. And then then that was very prone to erosion, mm-hmm. because it was open. Then they all gone now. You hardly see an open ditch there now. Everybody's gone to a plastic tile. And so that you have a, instead of the ditch. And that made it a lot easier, because it used to be a lot of tractors and wagons and stuff in the ditches and stuff.
Oh, yeah,
and
so now, the ditch.
Now, the, granted, you had that gave you a clear demarcation where your property ended. Mm-hmm. It also was the real hazard.
Well, I can tell you another problem that happened in the marsh was with these ditches is, and it's as good as the farmer is, what they would do, because land was valuable, they wanted the last inch. So they'd take a disc and then they'd have a scraper made behind it. And I don't know if you know what I mean by a scraper. They would put four 2x8s together and put them so that they were like that, mm-hmm. on a slant, and that would drag behind the disc to level the land out. And that was wider than the disc. So they get to the ditch, okay?